Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, of the making of books, there is no end. How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, today we continue our discussion of Peter Hessler's book, Country Driving, A Chinese Road Trip. Now remember, this is the last book we'll be discussing in our series, Around the World in Books. Our next series, Summer of Classics, begins on Monday, June 26th, and we will be reading Jane Austen's most loved book, Pride and Prejudice. So I really very much enjoyed interviewing Peter Hessler for last week's program. He really is a warm and friendly guy, and I can see why the Chinese people loved him and respected him. He was really kind to them, and they responded back in the same way. Well, we're not done with country driving yet, so I have the 60-plus panel with me in the studio today. So welcome, Daryl.
Welcome. Thank you.
Welcome, Deborah.
Hello. Thank you.
Well, as you both know, there is so much that we can discuss about this book. And I really believe that Peter does give us a detailed look at China and its people, but how are we ever going to talk about it all? It's just not even possible. So for all of you listeners out there, this is where you come in. You have to really read the whole book. And we can only give you some snippets, really, in these programs. But it really is a terrific book for you to read, and it is so good, I believe it will save you the expense of going to China. That's how good it is. You won't have to spend all that money and get the pollution in Beijing. So, but anyway, let's get to it today. So what I thought for today's program, let's just spend our time with book one, and it's titled The Wall. Now, for me, this is the most hilarious section of the book. The snippets that he gives us from the Chinese driving written test are absolutely hilarious. So I'm just going to read a few on page 30 and 31, and then we'll skip around a little bit. But my interview, for all of those who have listened to it, you know that we talked a little bit about the driving test. And I really wanted to know, is this really true? And, of course, Peter assured us it's absolutely true. And he said that the Chinese people really, when they're in a comfortable situation with a bunch of Chinese, we're all together, they actually can laugh at themselves. I don't think they necessarily like us laughing at them, but they can laugh at themselves. So here on page 30, he says he's giving number 77 out of a 429-question test. Now, I know, Derry, you've been in China, but would the test be the total of 429 questions, or would it be just...
That's probably a pool that they draw from.
Yeah, right. Okay. Because I was thinking, I thought, man, that would take hours to pass that test. But here's question number 77. When overtaking another car, a driver should pass on the left, on the right, wherever, depending on the situation. And, of course, Peter says number C is the correct answer for the Chinese. Wherever, depending on the situation. Here's question number 81. After passing another vehicle, you should A, wait until there is a safe distance between the two vehicles, making a right turn signal, and then return to the original lane. B, cut in front of the other car as quickly as possible. C, cut in front of the other car and then slow down. That sounds like road rage to me. Okay, here's question 117. It says, when approaching a marked pedestrian crossing, you should A, slow down and stop if there are pedestrians. B, accelerate in order to catch up with the car directly in front of you and then cross closely behind him. Or C, drive straight through because pedestrians should give vehicles the right of way. So I know you've been in Beijing.
Mm. Yes.
So many times. Oh, is it really like that when people are driving?
Well, you want to be very careful when you're on the road, either as a pedestrian or driving. Yes, for sure. It is pretty chaotic.
Okay, here's another one. And I don't want to read too many of these, but I do want to go back to page 29 quickly after this. This is question number 80. If while preparing to pass a car, you notice that it is turning left, making a U-turn or passing another vehicle, you should A, pass on the right, B, not pass, C, honk, accelerate, and pass on the left. Now, I know I read this before, but here's what he says. He says, for the most part, though, they're unflappable. He's talking about the Chinese drivers. And he's saying, and it's hard to imagine another place where people take such joy in driving so badly. On the open road, it feels like everybody has just been unleashed from a hutong. And is that how you say that?
Right, hutong.
And what is a hutong?
It's an enclosed little residential community that used to be the way people lived in these sort of very walled, restricted areas in cities. It's called a hutong.
And so they've just been let out.
Right.
I guess let out of prison. He said there's a sudden rush of speed and competition, and the greatest thrill comes from passing other motorists. People pass on hills, they pass on turns, they pass in tunnels. If they get past themselves, they immediately try to pass the other vehicle back, as if it were a game. From what I can tell, that's the only question on the written driver's exam with three correct answers. And I already read that to you. Where do you pass? And really, they just pass wherever they want to. So anyway, that's my part. That's what I wanted to talk about. So now I'll open up. Why don't we just start with Deborah the first time? Okay. Let her give us her insights on this first.
Well, yes, it is really funny. He talks about how the way they use the horn as well. He actually went to a driving school and watched how they actually taught driving, and it was understood that you just honk all the time, and you learn what the honks mean. But they don't turn the lights on when it gets dark. In fact, if you turn the lights on at night, the other drivers get annoyed with you for doing that. So there's so many really funny things, and they learn how to do things in the driving school that it's almost like a physical is like a physical coach for he's training them in some kind of a sport, or maybe a Chinese kind of martial arts almost. You know, it's very physical, and getting in and out of the car, or some of the things they don't talk at all about looking in the rearview mirror, or or looking out for other cars or anything like that. It's all about the physicality of turning the car on and off and using the brake and things like that. So it is very funny.
I think Peter did talk about that in the interview, and he said that there's such an emphasis on memorization in education that even to go learn how to drive a car, you have to memorize the exact movements, how to go to first and how to go to second, how to go to third and how to go to fourth and how to go to fifth. But you don't even have the car on, which is greatly damaging to the car.
Yes, right.
But they're just so much into memorization that you have to do everything just right. And you know, I think that's funny. So, Derry, what do you think of this first
book? Well, looking at the driving test, we see it as being so hilarious because of the three options. It's obvious to one there's one correct and the other two are absurd. But what is so ironic is that they're not absurd in China, because, in fact, there's one official correct answer, but the other two are most commonly what happens.
So that
someone taking the test, if they would go just by what they would normally see, they would normally see people driving up on the sidewalk and making and turning around. They would see people passing, you know, on the left and honking and yelling, and they would see those kinds of things, and they might think that's natural behavior, the kind of behavior that we desired. So when you look at these questions where they have these three choices, you can be sure that the most logical choice is the desired choice, but the other two are the most commonly occurring choices. So it's sort of shocking from that standpoint when you sort of see what
the landscape is like. So it's almost a memoir of what really happens.
It is. It really is. It really is. And as Deborah was saying about the obstacle course, and that carries over in not just driving tests but other things as well. If a student is able to drive a car up on two planks and do that successfully, that is a hard thing to do, but that makes them a good driver from the standpoint of the way they view it. The fact that you would need to look in the mirror, that you'd need to sort of check both sides, that you'd need to do safety measures would not be as important if you could do something that's very skilled and would require a skill or a learned oh, skill. Funny.
Yeah, well I know that, you know, I didn't put the numbers down, so you have to forgive me out there in the listening audience. But they thought when Peter took his test, he got in. They told him to start the car. He drove like 50 feet or 50 yards, and they said, turn off the car. He thought he had done something wrong. And the driver test official said, wow, you're a great driver.
Right.
So that's pretty funny. All right, let's move on. So you really need to read this first book and just love it, because he puts these snippets from the driving test all the way through it. But there is a lot of information in this first book as well. And again, I don't want to just I'll bring up the subject. How about that? But there, to me, I had this impression of the Great Wall, and this book totally changed my understanding of what the Great Wall is all about. And he explains that in here. So I'll let Deborah go ahead and talk about this. So, and I can give you the page numbers if you're hunting for them.
Yes,
it's page 22, 23, and 24. Yes. Okay, there you go.
Yes, that was one thing that was just amazed me, because it's really a Western myth about the Great Wall of China. We always see the pictures, I guess, of what the wall is near Beijing, and that's very large, and we assumed that it went all the way across China, but it turns out that there are areas where there's a line on the map of where the wall is, but it's actually looks just like the countryside, or it's been torn down, and it really does. In some places, there's several different lines of it. It's not even one continuous line. So that was very interesting. But it actually turns out it was a Western myth, and they start and then the myth that you can actually see the Great Wall from the moon. That was something that was just that's not true also. So yes. But it was interesting reading about that and seeing how that came about. So
I do think he does also bring out that I think Mao Zedong began to use that the Western impression of the wall, and he used it as propaganda. That I guess there was the I'm not going to be able to predict. The QI, is that Z or Q? The Qi dynasty, was that
the
it?
Qi dynasty.
Qi dynasty. Qi dynasty. Okay. So they use the X as an S. So I have to remember that. But the Qi dynasty, they built just out of tamped earth. Mm-hmm. They didn't build the big, massive structures with brick and the natural stone. That's what the Ming dynasty had done. And so that's what I think every Westerner's impression is, this massively high wall with the parapets and the, you know, the guard stations and all that. But that's really, that's only a small part of the actual wall. And so, but even Mao Zedong used that, you know, I guess it was to prove how great and strong the communist dynasty was. But we know that's not true. So go ahead, Derry, take it away now.
I think that the author is really ingenious, because he uses the wall as a metaphor for China. And obviously from Western eyes, when you think of China, the wall is the first thing you think of. Just like when you think of France, you think of the Eiffel Tower, or you think of, you know, the Brandenburg Gate for Germany. It is an iconic image that people have of China, this great wall. And he uses the wall as the backdrop for his driving trip, his journey across, which is very unique, because you sort of have this wall that he's using to refer to all of Chinese history, Chinese culture, things that have happened with regard to the wall throughout China over the decades and the centuries. And then he's stopping at these little places along the wall, and you're getting snippets of everyday life in the rural China. And so he uses the wall not only as sort of this cultural timeline, but he's also using it as a way in which he can meet people in villages along the way and sort of weave in a very personal narrative about China along with this cultural timeline that he has with the wall.
Yeah, I think it was very courageous actually what he did, because we talked about this in his interview, is technically he did something really illegal. He's a journalist. He wasn't to be traveling, you know, in a car by himself, and he wasn't to be out interviewing people by himself. He had to have a censor with him. But his Chinese was so good, and I guess he's dark haired and all that. They people would he'd pick up these hitchhikers. I thought it was interesting how, you know, I've done a lot of hitchhiking in my life back in the peaceful days in the 70s. Mm-hmm. You know, he'd pick up these hitchhikers, and they would just have these conversations with him, and then finally they'd look at him and say, "Are you Mongolian?" Because his Chinese was so good. Yeah. But it is. I don't think anybody that would go to Beijing today would get the views that he gives in his book. You would not get the views of the people or the contact with what's really going on inside China.
No, I don't think if you just go to Beijing or any of the large cities, you get a very cosmopolitan sense of a developed country. When you go out of the countryside, it's something quite different. So what he gives you is really that view of China, that rural view of China, and what the smaller towns are like. Where smaller towns in China are a million and under, you know, it's not like here. A small town's a million people, and then you get villages that are 100,000, 200,000. You know, people. He's talking about very small villages of several hundred people. So,
right.
So it's really a unique perspective on China that he's showing in a lot of ways.
I think when we see China, I know I said this a little bit in the last couple of programs. I just said that, you know, when I think of China, I think of, like, you know, seeing the cities, Beijing, just full of pollution, and, you know, you see some of that. Well, you see Hong Kong. You know, it's just this sprawling city. But when you drive along the wall, that's not what you get.
No.
You don't get it at all. And I think there's one of the phrases he uses in the book is that the leader, I'm not saying exactly right, but the leaders, the mountains are far from where the leaders mm-hmm. are. Mm-hmm. And so in other words, I finally got this view of China. You can't look at China through its leaders. You've got to.
Right.
You've got to look at China through a book like this.
Right. I think so. Because he's really giving you what the common man thinks and how the common man thinks. And there's an official view on everything, but then there is the way the commoner sees it, and based on the experience of life in a small town or life as generations has passed on from generation to generation in China. So, yeah, there really are two distinct Chinas, I think. The one that's the cosmopolitan, metropolitan China, and the one that's the rural China that he's talking about here, which is, as he shows in the book, is a China that's changing dramatically because of the migration to the large cities.
I think that was really interesting, especially in this first section when he was, we just call it like driving China, is that when he did pick up the hitchhikers, most of them were very young,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't want to be in the villages little villages. They didn't want to be there. They wanted to be gone, and that they were heading for the big city. But it's kind of interesting to me. I mean, you would never want to hitchhike in America today.
No.
It would be, I mean, even, like I said, I think the last time I probably hitchhiked was probably, you know, around 71, 72, and you still felt relatively mm-hmm. safe. But I even know that I even ran into a few incidences were kind of scary myself. But it just seems like the people now he appeared Chinese, he could speak Chinese very fluently, so they were comfortable with him. But it just seemed like that was the mode of transportation. Because there's no transportation, there's no public transportation. Certainly people in the villages can't afford cars.
No.
So when they saw a car, I thought it was interesting. They pretended like they were petting a dog.
that's the way that they hitch a ride. That's the symbol that they do with their hand.
Yeah.
It looks like they're petting a dog like this. It's sort of yeah. slow down and stop.
Oh, slow down.
Yeah,
okay.
So it looks like they're petting a dog. And
we just stuck our thumb up.
That's right. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is, Derry, you've been to China several times.
Right,
how many
right.
times have you been there?
Four
times. So you've experienced the cities. And have you been in the countryside? Have you
yes. seen the countryside is dramatically different. I mean, like I say, the cities are even much more modern than our cities and the cities of the United States. And they're very, very modern looking, very efficient, very pretty architecture. You go out, though, like an hour away from Beijing, and you've dropped back 150 years, it seems like, you know, in some of those rural areas in terms of what you see. And it's very undeveloped in lots of ways.
I think one thing that he does really well is, like I said, I think because being Western, I think because of, you know, the history and the social studies that we've got gotten in school is that when I think of China, I think of something like the Great Wall, and you just get this impression that it's this massive, organized country, but it's really not that way at all.
No.
And it's actually quite tragic what you read, you know, in this book. And you know, I asked him very specifically. I said, it just sounds to me like China is going through like what America and Britain did in the early, you know, the late 19th century and early 20th century with the Industrial Revolution, and how it had this major impact on families and cities and farms. And I mean, it really did, you know, turn everything upside down anyway. And so he said, yes, that's exactly what's happening in China, only it's really compressed and it's happening very fast. Mm-hmm. And so again, I'm not into like automobile facts and all that. But it just seems like, you know, even in America, I would say in the 40s and the 50s, I know our first car as a family, we didn't have a car for a long time. I remember I have three brothers, three sisters. We walked everywhere. We could walk to the grocery store and buy groceries. We carried them home for our parents. The school we went to was within our neighborhood. We just walked to school. We didn't need a car. And I remember the first car my dad bought was like a 48 Chrysler coupe, and all seven of us could fit in that back seat. It was just amazing. We were a little smashed together. But I think America experienced the what the automobile actually does for a country. And of course, you know, there was a lot of progress brought about by the automobile. It made people more mobile, but it also created a lot of problems. And I think that's exactly what's happening in China now.
Right. And I think, you know, the United States, we had a relatively longer period of time to absorb some of that change. In China, this has been collapsed and happening very fast. So what maybe happened in the United States over a 50, 60-year period has been happening in a 20, 30-year period in China. And so it's been much more dramatic on its effect on families and the structure of life in China.
But it is kind of interesting, though, that they still... The automobile is still a symbol of progressiveness, you know, getting ahead, or wealth. And of course, it's kind of out of control, I think, in this country.
And that's why I think you find in the book, you find hitchhikers so willing to get into a car, because, you know, we're horrified when we read that about you would get into a car with some stranger you don't know, you know, out here in the boonies somewhere. But in China, and it's certainly. And when he was writing this, there would be the sense that, well, if you have a car, you're a person of renown. So why wouldn't I trust you, you know, to take me somewhere?
Right. I think it's really, if I could just say this, I want to get this in. We're getting down. We're going to run out of time, which we knew we were going to anyway. So that's we don't have any trouble discussing anything. So 26 minutes goes really fast. But I think this is one of the key things he says in his first book, is how everyone is lost in China.
Right.
You know, there's a whole thing with the maps. We were getting ready for this program today, and you know, Peter makes a big comment about maps in China, and they're not very good. And then Derry was talking before, and he said, "I wish there was a better map in this book." And I was saying, "Well, maybe he put a bad map in just to show us how bad it was for him." And the Sino maps, and you know, it's like people in China. It's like, well, yeah, you need directions. You go down around the big rock and go towards the big tree. You know, you don't need that. But here's I think this is really funny, but it's not funny in a way. And this is really, I think it's a description of where China is right now. It says, in China, it's not such a terrible thing to be lost, because nobody else knows exactly where they're going either. It says, in the summer of 1996, when I first arrived in the country as a Peace Corps volunteer, I was immediately impressed by my own ignorance. Language, custom, history, all of it had to be learned, and the task seemed insurmountable. From my perspective, everybody else had a head start of 3,000 years, and I felt desperate to catch up. But when you read this book one, you realize in terms of history and all that, people don't seem to care. You know, they don't. And we'll talk about this in our next section, is the next program as well. But it is, you know, it's kind of like China is, no one knows exactly where China is right now.
Right, right.
And where are they in their history and where they're going? So in some ways, that's kind of very interesting. Okay, well, it looks like we're running out of time today. So next time, the 60-plus panel, we will be back together again, and we'll discuss Book 2, The Village. I would very much like to hear what you have to say about country driving. Please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1, and you can also follow JBL on Facebook. The address is facebook.com/justthebestliterature. And remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.